Hello everyone, I'm Colin Ellis, and for 30 years I was a permanent employee of other people's cultures. What I wanted to know more than anything else during that time was how to build a great culture myself. And so I wrote a book called Culture Fix, which is the world's first how-to guide for building great workplace culture. And in this, the Culture Makers podcast, I get industry leaders from around the world to expand on the ideas that I wrote about in the book and get them to share actionable things that you can do to create a great place to work yourself. And remember, listening is good, but action is better. Welcome to another Culture Makers podcast. Today I'm joined by Otty Vogt. Otty is a disruptive thinker and global C-level transformation leader with over 20 years of experience in implementing strategic business change in multicultural complex organizations. He is passionate about personal and organizational transformation and has made it his purpose to build global high-performing teams that deliver sustainable shareholder value and, importantly, happiness at work. He's also an amateur poet, by the way, and I highly recommend that you seek out his tour, his blog, which you can find on his LinkedIn page, which they are great. He's currently the Chief Operating Officer and Chief Transformation Officer of the Challenger and Growth business at ING Bank, based in Amsterdam. And he joins me now. Hello, Otty.
Hello, Colin. What a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. So I'm just going to jump straight on with the passionate about personal and organizational transformation. Where did that start for you? Because it's not like you took your first job or university and you were like, you know what I'm passionate about? It's organizational transformation. So where did that start for you, that interest in doing that?
That's actually a very, very good observation, Colin. I have to admit, I mean, who, when they were children, were dreaming about becoming a manager or something like that? maybe astronauts or a fireman or other things, but manager probably was on nobody's wish list. So I think for me, this started really when I first joined a startup company, talking the early 90s, kind of when I had left my original home in Germany and went to Italy to join this company. And it became very evident from the start that actually there was something in it, something exciting about how to bring people together to achieve something jointly that kind of as individuals we couldn't possibly achieve. And I think this curiosity has been with me throughout university when I started to work in international student associations, where again in the context of non-for-profit, or how do you inspire people to come together and create something that is truly relevant and important and has impact. And I think it has stayed with me ever since. So somehow I was catapulted into this world and felt that I had maybe also a little bit of a skill in bringing people together, and that further on has remained with me throughout.
It's one of those things that I often hear whenever I'm speaking at conferences. I'll hear other CEOs get up and say, "Oh, we want to think like a startup." I feel like they constrain people from actually thinking like a startup and actually growing and building a culture. So was it pretty much here's what we have to achieve and here's what we need to build in order to get that?
Yes, I think there are lots of things to say, and of course you're a renowned expert in the field. One thing that struck me was culture is what people call a derivative property. So it is not something that can be directly impacted. It is really a result of kind of behaviors and norms and underlying assumptions and values and kind of history that have developed with a group of people or a social system over time. So I think understanding the importance of culture, but also I think Otto Scharmer always has this notion of beaming the beam of reflection of the system back to the individual. So understanding our role in creating culture and the system is a fascinating enterprise. And I think, if I'm honest, most people who I've seen, and I include myself in that for many years, are amateurs in actually being able to see what is happening around them, because it's not so evident. We all sometimes suggest that culture is like what you pick up when you're just moving around in an organization, right? So you just go in and you observe, and that's the culture. And that is, of course, true. But this proverbial iceberg also implies that there's lots of stuff underneath that is not so evident to actually see. And I think people need to somehow refine their antennas. There's almost like a kind of a radar they have to develop to fully understand what is happening in a complex organizational system.
Yeah, that's so true. It's something that I think I've mentioned before on the podcast. It's certainly something I've written about, is that we don't teach people about organizational culture. We expect to have a good one and we talk about the importance of it, but we don't actually teach people the component parts of it. We don't talk about the personal responsibility. We talk about leadership as if it's a hierarchical position rather than a personal choice. Is that something that you would agree with?
I mean, I couldn't agree more, frankly, because I was writing a little article the other day, as I've just completed my psychodynamic coaching certificate with INSEAD, the business group in France. And reflecting on my career, I've got a library of business books at home, and I've got an MBA, and I've got lots of personal development plans and 360 feedbacks over the years, etc. Nevertheless, I have to admit that it took me a long, long time to fully realize the impact I personally have on the system and that I can have on the system in creating that culture. Because leaders create culture with everything they say and every move they make, which on the one hand gives them a magic power to influence people around them. And I think there's some research that shows that kind of the behavior of subordinates in a hierarchical system, up to 60-70% is modeled on the superiors. So there's a transmission mechanism that leaders can access in order to influence culture around them. But that implies also a very strong responsibility to do so in a responsible fashion, which again goes back to your point. People need to understand how to do so and what it means to do that in a certain way. How do you get more vigilant towards the underlying anxiety that is present in every human system? And it's fascinating to observe that. And what I've learned, I think, is that if you're unable to see that anxiety that is in every system, then very often you're unable to make it a positive force towards the purpose of that system, to help it to express itself and move into a certain direction. And it comes up in other shapes and forms that are not conducive to the system's success. So it is a very fine art, I guess, in regards to actually being able to influence culture in a responsible and a conscious way to achieve certain results.
That is such a fantastic insight, Otty, and it made me reflect. I've just started working with an organization and I was talking to the CEO and he said, one of our big challenges is burnout. I said, many people are going through burnout issues at the minute. And I said, give me a sense of your organizational practices. I sent the conversation off in a different way. And then he mentioned he'd be up all night sending emails. I was like, how do you think people feel when they receive that email late at night, super early in the morning? He's like, they'll just accept that that's me. I said, but by doing that, what you're actually doing is setting the tone for everybody else. And then people will feel a pressure either to respond or to be always on waiting for your emails. And then you get burnout.
Yeah, and we're trained that way, right? When I left school, I left university rather, then I wanted to become an entrepreneur, but the famous internet bubble burst at the time. So next best thing, I went into consulting and eventually ended up in telecommunications. And I recall that initially, at least, there was a culture whereby people were looking who was the last person to leave the office and how long it would take people to respond to out of office hours emails over the weekend or in the late evening. So there was a culture of delivery and execution as opposed to what I would sustain makes a great place to work, which is a more human-centric organization where there's bonds of trust and mutual respect and really the desire to help people develop and express their potential, which also implies that as a leader, I need to let go of some of that desire to control around me. Right? And I had one of my friends and to a degree people I look up for guidance is Brian Ungert, who is the chief purpose officer in Decurion, one of the deliberately developmental organizations that Bob Keegan talks about. And he is always saying there's a big difference between learning and development. Learning is about knowledge. Development is about letting go. And this internal journey for leaders to let go so they can become positive agents of a a liberated, energetic, joyful, harmonious culture, a compassionate and kind culture around them is a very important, yet I think sometimes undervalued journey that executives, I think, need to go on at some stage if they want to become very impactful in regards to what you talk about, which is creating a positive culture.
Very true. And one of the quotes that I remember from one of the videos that I watched of you, and you were talking about leadership and about how in order to become leader, you have to put yourself in service. And you talked about the fact that servant leaders lead beyond the ego. So it's less about what they want to get out of it and more about what can I do for other people. And have there been those kind of people across your career, Otti, that have really impacted you in that way? Or is it something that you've just kind of grown into and recognized?
Many of them. I was quite lucky, I think, to have been exposed to some leaders who, in their own way, reflected some of the characteristics that I feel are very important in that context. So very early on, I was working for, and I'm very happy to name him, as a gentleman called Sinclair Stockman, who was the CIO of British Telecoms Global at the time, and who really impersonated that full and human integrity in a leader. And I think also in terms of creating an environment around him where people flourished, contributed, created innovation, and always came up with new ideas, and who personally gave me many opportunities to just express my authentic leadership around him. And so that is one example. But also in later years, I think I'm finding, particularly during the last 1 or 2 years, I think this pandemic is bringing up some of that desire more than in previous years, maybe. I'm finding very, very stimulating personalities who share their own journeys and the challenges that they have to overcome to become these servant leaders that you mentioned earlier. And that is very powerful. And I'm strongly convinced there's a new book out by Keith Ferrazzi where he talks about leadership without authority. And he talks about this concept of co-elevation. I'm very convinced that some of this development that leaders, I believe, should go through is dialogical, is in kind of peer communities, is with a buddy, someone who can point out to you some of the blind spots that you might have or help you in making meaning out of what is happening around you. So there's people elevating themselves together. I think it's a very, very important concept and one that I'm trying to help implement here at ING as well.
That's a fantastic idea. Now you spent, I just want to talk briefly about British Telecom because you spent over 11 years there. Was all of that time in London? And if so, did you see, obviously you've worked all over, you've worked in Italy, France, obviously Holland, Germany, you're from Germany. Was different culturally as well there? So you had the corporate culture, you had your different roles within that, and then you had the obviously the English culture as well on top of it. How did you find kind of managing all of that, Otti?
Yeah, I think again it's a very, very intriguing question, Colin. There's, so the global division of British Telecoms at the time was present in over 120 different geographies, and my team, when I kind of the last roles that I had, stretched more than kind of 45 different countries. So I've often found myself in roles where my kind of beyond the actual task, my underlying mission was to create community across cultures. And that is very similar to my current job. So bringing people from different perspectives in regards to not only the matrix organization, where always kind of hierarchy plays a role. So there's a functional kind of line and there's a hierarchical line and they sometimes create tension. But then overlaid with that, as you suggest, the cultural dimension were key parts of the puzzle in creating that shared energy to bring the system to achieve its purpose. And yes, there are big differences. So I experienced big differences in regards to corporate culture between, for example, ING as a kind of Dutch organization vis-a-vis British Telecom, a typically Anglo-Saxon organization. There are also some similarities in terms of openness and being very straightforward and being able to move to walk into the CEO's door without big challenges. But what I found is significant differences in the different countries. A Turkish culture vis-a-vis a Polish culture, a German culture, or or a Asian culture are very different. And to a degree, in creating that amalgamation of energy, that needs to be taken into account. If I am having a one-to-one with a manager who happens to be in my team in one of these geographies, I always have to take a little bit of time to reflect, okay, what am I trying to achieve? What is the context and how can I bring that message across?
And so then that really, did you learn all the way through kind of your, what I would call your junior management career, but obviously you held fairly senior posts, constantly learning, you had that relentless curiosity about what would work, what wouldn't. Did you kind of bring that disruptive, and I mean positive disruption, that disruptive nature to, you know, how can we help people to be happy and engaged in everything that they do? Was that something that you constantly looked for ideas and ways to develop that?
Yes, I wasn't always conscious. I think in retrospect, sometimes your life's journey looked like a perfect plan. And of course, that's not how things turned out, right? It was very much a constant adaptation and jumping on trains in terms of opportunities. But a few things stand out for me in terms of my own learning. One was a merger and acquisition where I happened to be in charge of integrating one of the biggest acquisitions we had made outside the UK back into the mother organization. And one thing here I believe I picked up was the fact that emotions, again, this under the iceberg phenomenon is so important in kind of creating community. And especially in that context, it was about also creating a moment of closure, right? So this emotional closure, people who had a history and heritage with one culture and organization who were becoming part of something bigger but different. So allowing people to go through that process and having that moment of catharsis. And it was in Italy at the time, so catharsis in Italy had to be a party, right? So we had to create balloons going off into the skies. We had music and speeches. But there is an element of taking care of that emotional aspect. Then another occasion that I recall was I was in charge of creating a global consulting organization within the context of an internal consultancy as part of this big telecoms player. And again, a consulting firm, be it inside a bigger organization, had a very different culture. And I remember that the biggest challenge was me coming in as a junior manager, dealing with these partner level consultants who were kind of to a degree, I don't want to say prima donnas, but experts and gurus in their space. And the last thing they were kind of accepting was that little manager coming their way and trying to bring them all onto the same page and living with kind of dealing with that culture. And then finally, maybe one example that brings out maybe that rebellious aspect that you mentioned was I founded a little society which was called the BT Breakfast Club, where we brought together people that we thought were forward thinking and talented and inspirational across the whole organization and try to create a social network, social capital to propagate kind of human-centric management, but also innovation. And again, that was kind of a bit of wildness in the context of a hierarchical organization, and it came out brilliantly. So these were some of the experiences that I picked up along the way, and also which kind of made me believe that there is a lot to be done if people dare to or have the courage to revise how they design work. And this is something Carol Sanford in particular, one another lady who I look up to in terms of guidance and insights, is always suggesting that work has to be designed intentionally. And we very often, because we are clinging to the hierarchy or to the status or the roles that we have with a lot of inertia, we are not allowing ourselves to really look at whether we're organized in an effective way to achieve the purpose that we ultimately want to achieve.
Awesome. Yeah, Carol Sanford, who wrote the book, No More Feedback, Cultivate Consciousness at Work, which I highly recommend. Now, I want to talk to you about ING. So ING were an organization that I researched not long after I'd started working for myself, actually, in, it must have been 2016, maybe 2017. I read an interview with Bart Schlappman, who I believe was the COO at the time. I think he's CEO of Allianz now. And I remember reading, because everyone was going on about Agile, now, Agile was the latest thing, even though kind of me and my teams had done it a bunch of years earlier, but that's okay. I've got over that. And I remember he said, it was in the paper, it was about a McKinsey paper. He said, Agile is about minimizing handovers and bureaucracy and empowering people. And then I went and did a bunch of research on ING, and really that ethos runs through the entire organization in terms of how can we remove barriers to actually getting things done in a way that still helps us retain kind of an element of control and delivery. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. So indeed, Bart was the CEO of the Netherlands at the time, and he and his team introduced Agile first in the Netherlands. And then throughout the last few years, we've taken Agile as a methodology globally and across almost all of our business functions. So from the traditional space where it's been deployed in IT, we also moved into sales and service and support. And it was a very, very intriguing journey. And I'm kind of, I'm almost saying there's an Agile 1.0, which is deployed inside IT, very much as a product development method. And then there's an Agile 2.0, which moves to this notion of Agile Enterprise, which is much more about how to stimulate organizational learning at scale. And therefore, is about mindset and context and culture, probably more than methods. And I think that is where some of the challenges are really surfacing. And to your point about ING being a very kind of innovative in that regard and trying to avoid handovers, that is definitely true. We're also very collaborative in organization. And we have, at the same time, in all the countries that we operate in, a culture of innovation where people are very strong in terms of the customer centricity and being out there in the market with innovative products and services. And the challenge since 2016 has been very much to try to create a platform and scale all and harness all that innovation that is in these different geographies into a single co-creation. And this is where kind of I came into the picture as much as kind of other people to help with crystallizing the organization into something that could create what we call faster time to volume. So you normally talk about time to market in the context of a single market. Time to volume in our lingo is about generating that same of innovation across multiple markets. And this has been a hugely inspirational journey, and one where, again, I would come back to the context of this call. A lot about it is not about technology, is not so much about processes or procedures or methodologies as such, but the underlying culture. People being able to work with each other and care for and generate something together.
Do you then make sure that anybody that you add to the team, to that culture, then, Otty, you bring them in a way where they understand not just the kind of technical components of the job, but also those very human elements, those elements of connection, of behavior, of collaboration? Is that something you're very deliberate about?
Absolutely. And I would go back to this context of deliberately developmental organizations where alongside the formal task, which is achieving whatever outcomes the organization suggests, you're looking at adult development in terms of building the agency in people to actually contribute themselves to that common mission. And secondly, the community development and bringing people together and really using community as a means to generate collective emergent purpose, speaking a little bit in the lingo of Fred Laloux. So we're working along all these angles. So there's an element of bringing the right people in. There's an element of creating the conditions for people to develop themselves. And I'm experimenting here with kind of peer coaching and facilitated reflection, using some of the agile coaches at team level. So people becoming more adaptable, more experienced or seasoned in regards to dealing with the interaction patterns at team level or across team level. So they actually can self-organize in a way that is helpful to achieve the outcomes that they want to achieve. And at the same time, we are creating a context where we are putting in place, for example, some of the structures used in sociocracy or holacracy beyond what was Agile, because Agile doesn't really prescribe any organizational structure. So there are elements that we use from holacracy, but now I'm also experimenting with sociocracy and building, for example, circles across different countries and using decision making by consent rather than traditionally by advisor. In a hierarchy, we often kind of see command and control. Right? So being much more conscious and intentional about how you develop that organization, I think, is an important part of moving kind of the culture, shifting the culture towards a probably more adaptive culture in terms of self-managing towards changes in the environment. At the same time, as you said, also more human-centric. So all these elements, I think, have to be considered and come into play.
For you personally, you know, in terms of your own development, are you constantly looking outside of what you know, what your own experience is, and looking to challenge yourself?
Very much so, very much so. And I have to admit, this has been a kind of a long journey, and certainly cannot pretend that I always picked up the learnings that I could have picked up. I think it also has to do a little bit with age, that it becomes probably easier to let go. But certainly for me, I've realized that the organizational transformation without individual transformation is non-existent. If you want to be successful in taking others somewhere, you have to start with yourself. And I think here, becoming a coach, and especially this notion of system psychodynamics, which INSEAD is famous for, has helped me enormously. One, in understanding the context of the system, the human system in all its various aspects, both emotional and more kind of rational, but then also the psychodynamics in terms of understanding how do my inner conditions shape my outer conditions, being able to work with my own emotions and fears maybe, or preconceptions in terms of interpreting what's going on around me, but also being able to offer that reading, that interpretation to other people.
Otty, this has just been a fantastic 25 minutes. I can't believe how quickly it's gone. I want to say a huge thank you for not only giving up your time, but also sharing with us your thoughts on the Culture Makers podcast today. I'm sure everyone will find it hopefully as enjoyable as I have. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Colin. And last point for me maybe is that this is an important time for all of us, I think, to become part of that evolution towards better organizations. If ever there has been a moment in history where that was clearly important, it is now. And I really hope that the work that you're doing, Colin, will bear fruits in other people coming onto that movement. So thank you very much for all your efforts.
Thanks so much, Otty. Thanks so much for listening to today's podcast. Please remember to subscribe or share the link on your social media platform of choice, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, wherever you hang out. You can also forward it onto your colleagues and friends and help them to inspire and motivate others too. Better still, why not keep the conversation going and join our community of culture makers from around the world who share information on the things that have worked and haven't worked? You can do that at www.culturefixcommunity.com. And remember, sharing is caring. See you next time.